Hello, and welcome to Credit Notes, a new podcast in partnership with AIG that aims to provide a deeper dive into the world of trade finance and the critical issues impacting global commerce. My name is Sam Lowe. I'm a partner at Flink Global and head of its trade and market access practice. Joining me today for our first episode to discuss the complexities of digitalization in the trade finance sector are our three eminent guests: James Binns, Global Head of Trade and Working Capital for Barclays; Sharmika Siramane, Director of UNCTAD's Division on Technology and Logistics; and Anna Isaac, City Editor of The Guardian newspaper. Everyone, hello.
Nice to be here.
Hello, everyone. It's great to be here.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you so much for joining us. I thought before getting into discussing the complexities of digitalization in the trade finance space, we should probably start from the beginning and actually have a conversation about trade finance itself and its complexities. And I thought, James, that perhaps you might be the right person. You've worked on this for a really long time. You're sort of in the business doing it. You're probably the right person to start with.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, I've been doing this for nearly 30 years, and every year I think I know it, and then I realize there's something else I don't know. So yeah, look, trade is hugely complex. Just look at supply chains. They are multilateral. They cross different borders, different regions, different continents. You know, one single supply chain can have five or six different layers, suppliers of suppliers of suppliers. And of course, because trade is inherently cross-border and multilateral, that brings in all sorts of different elements. There's currency translation, there's trust and credibility issues between the different counterparties. There's different regulations in different countries and different regions, you know, free trade agreements or trade barriers, for example. And of course, there's different legal frameworks as well that determine the exchange of documentation and the laws around trade across all those different countries. And then you look at the number of different counterparties involved in a single shipment. You've got shipping companies, you've got inspection agencies, you've obviously got buyers and sellers, you've got customs agencies, et cetera, et cetera. So there are multiple different parties involved in a single transaction. And if you've ever seen a letter of credit and the documents that get presented back against the letter of credit, I've seen many of them. And a single set of documents can be, you know, very, very high. There can be multiple 20 odd documents in a single presentation. I've even seen bills of lading that go up to 130 odd pages in length. So you think about the amount of data and the amount of people involved in different companies in creating those documents. And that gives you an idea of some of the complexity that's involved in trade. And you think about everything that I've just said, and then you think about some of the risks that trade incorporates. Obviously, there's credit and counterparty risk. There's financial crime and anti-money laundering risk that needs to be considered. And trade, inherently international, is very susceptible to geopolitical risk and geopolitical uncertainty. Just look at what's going on in the Red Sea at the moment and the impact that's having on the Suez Canal and shipments of containers, etc., from east to west. Trade is also very susceptible to climate risk. And if you think about some of the climate events that have happened over the years, you know, in India with the very high temperatures last year, which inhibited wheat production. If you look at the currently with the Panama Canal and water levels being very low and obviously impeding the amount of ships that can go through that. So again, climate and sustainability is a big consideration. And of course, once you overlay that onto supply chains in general, you realize that supply chains are obviously very complex, but to some extent, they're inherently fragile as well. And we saw that during COVID, if you remember, you know, with all of that supply chain volatility that came with COVID, container cycles being all over the place, and obviously, as a result, transport logistics prices going up hugely. So I love trade, but it is inherently complex. And that's probably one of the reasons I like it so much, because I think it's so fascinating.
And when you're sort of approaching that, even from a commercial perspective, are those all data points you have to take into account when you make a decision whether to, I suppose, lend or engage or underwrite or whatever you're doing with the given client? And I mean, how? How do you sort of synthesize all of that into a number, into say, you know, an interest rate?
So we all have different ways of doing it, different frameworks, different risk frameworks and so on. But the beauty of trade for me is that because everything we do is linked to an underlying transaction or contract, we know exactly what we're financing. And therefore, we have a huge amount of data available to us when we make those decisions, those risk-based decisions, what we want to finance, what we don't want to finance, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, for me, that's one of the strengths of trade. And I know we're going to talk about digitization later on, but if we can use digitization to start harnessing that data more efficiently and more effectively, then we can start to make more efficient risk-based decisions and actually start to make trade more inclusive, more accessible, to supply chains as a whole.
That's a good time to turn to Sharmika. You obviously spend a lot of time thinking about trade in the context of the developing world, and helping sort of companies and people who wouldn't otherwise engage with it sort of get into global supply chains and interact. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts from that perspective in terms of with the trade finance overlay on top, what sort of challenges are people facing? You know, what makes it difficult? And what are the perceived risks for lenders in that context?
Okay, thank you, Sam, for this question. I was listening to James and, looking at how he portrayed the trade finance in the, in the environment of Barclays. Now I'm going to take you to developing countries, and which has an enormously different picture. You see, in most developing countries, there is not a wide range of financing options, and financial markets are pretty thin. The commercial banks are the predominant lenders, and they're pretty small. And with regard to capitalization, as a result, and they are also very risk averse. So what does this mean? That means commercial banks prefer to lend to individuals rather than to businesses. So we are not even going to the exporters. So it would rather give to individuals rather than to businesses. And within the businesses, lending to retail business is preferred than lending to other activities. Now, when it is an exporter, unless the exporter is very big and well known, banks are very reluctant to extend loans to small, medium-sized exporters, and developing countries are, full of the small, medium-sized exporters. I think some of the reasons are, apart from the small capitalization, the thin markets, it's the lack of credit risk assessment and mitigation measures. And I guess lack of contractual enforcement measures. I think all these things contribute to the problem. Let me give you an example from some of the work we do. We go to countries and assess countries' readiness to do e-commerce and the digital economy. And we have done these assessments in about 50 countries now. So we assess the readiness of firms in terms of ICT infrastructure, financing, payment system, legal regulatory frameworks, logistics, and so forth, and skills. And financing comes as one of the most difficult barriers to do e-commerce. Now, which is not surprising in a way, because e-commerce, as we all know, is a new business model. And they are mostly startups run by young people, I mean, young women entrepreneurs, for example. And this segment does not register as a safe bet for commercial banks in many of the developing countries we work. And most times the capital is raised through personal savings or borrowing from family and friends. So it's not from financial markets. So unfortunately, while cross-border e-commerce could be an extremely lucrative business for developing countries, and rarely, very rarely, exporters in developing countries, except in China, venture into this space. So, just to wrap up, financing is a huge difficulty for firms to get bigger and walk into export markets in e-commerce and in the whole digital space.
I think that really resonates. And I don't know if you want to come in on that at all, James, just in terms of if that's something that, you know, you sort of relate to, and even if just from a global bank perspective, if there is the acknowledgement that there are, you know, some geographies are more challenging than others, and it's to do with levels of development and just general infrastructure.
No, absolutely. Look, I totally acknowledge what Shamika was just saying. Everyone talks, well, not everyone, but a big topic of conversation is the trade finance gap. And the trade finance gap, there's different ways of estimating it, but is at least $1 trillion by any estimation. And the point I raised earlier on about using technology and digitization to make trade more accessible is key to solving that problem. And because if we can solve that problem, then we can start to treat supply chains as an ecosystem as a whole, rather than look at individual counterparties within that on a standalone basis, which is, I think, one of the problems which, you know, Shamika was talking about. But equally, there are a lot of challenges to get there. And obviously, we're going to be talking about that throughout the rest of the podcast as to how we overcome some of those challenges. But absolutely, you know, the topic of making trade finance more inclusive, more available, more accessible to supply chains as a whole, so that we can all start to work together and collaborate to close that trade finance gap, is absolutely a very prevalent topic in trade finance across banks, multilateral agencies, trade bodies, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've identified, we're starting with the risks, and we are going to start talking about some solutions by the end, so that we don't just stay down in the doldrums. Shamika, I wondered, just coming back to you before I have a couple of questions for Anna. Do you think, given the sort of difficulties from a commercial perspective, there is this role for multilateral agencies and groups in sort of either providing the funding or providing some of the infrastructure? And I'm sure this is something that you even engage with directly, and I'd be interested in hearing about that.
I think so. I think in this space, everybody has a role to play. The development partners, the multilateral agencies, private sector, you know, you name it. It's, as I said, for example, to get into to engage in e-commerce and the digital economy, you need many things in place. You need, for example, regulatory frameworks, you know, legal and regulatory frameworks for data protection, cybersecurity, data privacy, consumer protection. And these are many times capacity building endeavors. You know, you need to build a massive amount of capacities. We need to help countries to write the laws and regulatory measures. And so there is a space for, you know, us, UNCTAD, for example, in my division, we have a program where we support countries to write their laws in that space of e-commerce and the digital economy. And I think we will talk a bit about when we start talking about other logistics, for example, the automation of customs processes. I think, James, you started to talk about the massive compliance at the borders. And many of these things can be done better by digitalization, automating trade procedures. And there we have done a lot of work. In UNCTAD, for example, we do technology transfer. We go and help countries to develop their platforms, for example, customs platforms, and we train people and we hand over the source code. So there are many ways we can build capacity, we can do technology transfer, and in many ways the donors can come and, you know, put fiber and develop the ICT infrastructure. Many things can be done, but it is extremely important we do these things together so that we do not, you know, work in isolation. We need to go together, the external partners, and listen to countries and see what they want rather than what we want installed. So there is a need for that coordination of efforts across these external partners.
Yeah, thank you. Anna, turning to you, because we've sort of been getting a more of a practitioner look on this. As a journalist who I know very well and now has quite a deep understanding of trade and also the financing around it, I just wondered if you had any views on sort of going back to the original question of this segment. Why is it, you know, it's a complex sector and it does pop up in the news every now and then. So without naming any specific names, I just wondered if you could discuss sort of general trends and any observations you have about why this is the case.
My legal team will be thrilled about me not naming any names. Yes, so I think the biggest thing coming at it from a reporting perspective, which is often very similar to a compliance and risk perspective, is who owns what and who might also benefit in any particular way. So ultimately, like who's the beneficial owner. And that's been a particular risk that has stood out when it comes to the application of and enforcement of financial sanctions against both individuals and also state-linked entities. And that can become very challenging within the context of trade finance because, as James described, and as Shamika pointed towards, you know, when you're involving many jurisdictions, many layers within supply chains, it can ultimately be very difficult to work out who are the counterparties in any given contract all the way down that system, be that, you know, trading in a particular commodity. We've seen that a lot with energy commodities trading since the most recent invasion of Ukraine and the war there. It really feeds into the who is party to any given transaction within the trade finance world. And also kind of a bigger trend has been more scrutiny of those people who are facilitating trade finance or the professional services around it that build into the physical or financial transactions that underpin it. So the professional service providers have had more scrutiny of their role within the movement of goods and services around the world than I think they've probably had for quite some time. And ditto the financial institutions that have been involved with that, particularly when it comes to Russian and Iranian sanctions in recent years. So that's obviously been hot topics for journalists in general, but whenever you're trying to look at the health of a company, obviously looking at its engagement within trade finance is often a very good way of doing it because it can be one of the areas where you can take a closer look at the true health of its balance sheet if you look at what it assets it might have in different jurisdictions from that point of view. But that's a very reportery perspective, and there may be a sort of more nuanced way to talk about risks or trends. But I think that notion of finding the ultimate beneficial owner within the trade world remains very fascinating, but also is a big trend within reporting.
And I suppose it just is important to know who you're dealing with. And when you're talking about trade, where to an extent it's unknowable, right? You know, as in you might know your immediate counterpart, but you don't necessarily know all the people they're interacting with. And you can get a very good idea of it and you can work that out. But there's always a slight risk that there's something you've missed.
Absolutely. And that obviously that can get a bit terrifying from my perspective if I, you know, risk some defamation. But that's really important from a sort of regulatory and trend perspective. So one of the things that, you know, we might touch upon in a bit is the know your customer aspect and how that has evolved over time and how that feeds into difficulties within sectors where it becomes very high risk if they're expected to do a very onerous amount of enhanced due diligence and dealing with certain clients in this new, risky geopolitical context and the pressure that's put on correspondent banking, for instance. So this key part within the trade finance world where you might traditionally have relied more on the recipient banks know your customer checks and how in the eyes of some regulators that's less acceptable these days, depending on the risk associated with the client, although James will obviously know much more about the technicalities of that. But also in areas, again, we'll talk about sort of innovation in the space where it's people have almost found themselves more able to do more opaque transactions enabled by technology in some ways. But, institutions like the Financial Action Task Force are trying to encourage more transparency within the system, or at least more requirements on a transacting party who might not have been regarded as a payment services provider, for instance, to have done its due diligence on sort of where the money's going, not just where the money's come from, which is obviously a big part of any financial dealings, but particularly within trade finance or those who might be, for instance, under particular scrutiny with their trade activities because of financial sanctions. So that's an area that's particularly interesting. But also, you know, things like the imposition of Basel III and the impact that has in terms of the liquidity that's required by different parts of the financial system has also made it sort of harder for some participants. So, you know, the more you squeeze at any given end of the trade finance system, the interesting sort of spillover effects you tend to have. And I like think about them from sort of a macro point of view, as well as the sort of the more intriguing wheelers and dealers of high net worth that I come across from time to time.
Thank you. And I think that's a good point to move on to discussing innovation and digitization in the sector, because in a way, you know, it's complex. We're talking about moving things around the world. That's never going to be the easiest thing to do. And that entire ecosystem is always going to be a bit of a challenge. But of course, in the modern era, the world is starting to feel smaller, at least in terms of our ability to communicate with each other and to discuss, and also even to fully experience being in other places. We're discussing virtually right now. I don't actually know where everyone is based at this moment in time. But in the context of trade finance, let's start from the beginning, because I think before we can discuss innovation and digitization, I mean, James has already alluded to this, but I might go back to you, Anna. For a long while, this wasn't the most innovative bit of the economy, I would say. I think, is that fair to say?
I don't know about that, because I consider a lot of quite definite innovators with it. I call them innovators. That's a good word for it. Innovators within the insurance market, I think have been innovating throughout time. And it's just because no one's looking at it didn't mean it was boring, I guess. Perhaps didn't blow up in the way that certain other areas did. But when I was thinking about, sort of like starting from the beginning with this as a bit of a linguistics geek, I was like, oh, well, where should we start? Should we start with ancient Mesopotamia and some of the clay forms where you were reliant on one tablet for checking out all of the different transactions people might rely on, or Linear B in Greece? But I guess the point is that, James would sort of be the owner of the tablet at Barclays or whatever, but that actually is quite a useful way to think about, things like digital ledgers and the notion of this perfect record that we might be able to somehow achieve of all of the transactions that have happened, and this complete transparency we might get or is often promised by people who are interested in blockchain. But in terms of innovation in sector, the pace of payments, so as mobile banking has changed, the pace of payments is one of the things that's been sort of staggeringly different. And access to banking with mobile phones has allowed and I'm sure Shamika is coming across this in terms of legislation and contract law might not be keeping pace with the pace of transactions. And how does that fit with the world of trying to develop international best practice on e-commerce legislation? But for a long time, people like me in newsrooms weren't fascinated by bills of lading or trying to work out who was moving a good where. But then as soon as, any commodities get frisky, so the oil shock in the 70s, people found trade finance very interesting then. And you have these waves of geopolitical risk that get people like me very excited. And obviously oil's been a really good case in point recently, where you know if your market's reporting, as I used to a lot, you could literally see a tanker turn around and a price shift. And so risk as well as innovation has been what's kind of changed the game, I think.
And James, I mean, from your perspective, what sort of technologies are being used now? You have been doing this for quite a long time, so you've probably sort of seen each iteration of technology and new development, and you probably had lots of people present to you saying this thing's going to change your world. So it'd be good to get a sense actually of what's sort of working, what's not, any barriers to uptake.
So I've seen a lot over the last three decades, and obviously there's been a number of blockchain solutions out there which have come and gone. I won't name them, but blockchain has not been a big success to date in trade. I do think it will be a success in the future. What we're predominantly seeing at the moment is API-based technologies. APIs is application programming interface, and that enables more seamless connectivity between different technology platforms. And that is really helping to drive a lot more digitization at the moment across the trade sector. Another thing that we're seeing is optical character recognition. This is technology, it's machine learning and AI-based, which can start to recognize different types of documents, so classify what is a bill of lading versus a commercial invoice, etc., and then understand which are the key data fields within that so that you can start to digitize that data and then use that data digitally from there on within the trade finance transaction. I think there's a number of inhibitors. One of the inhibitors has actually been our own core systems across companies, banks, and so on. Those are often legacy in nature and not necessarily API-enabled or as API-enabled as they could be. So to start with, I'm a huge believer that we all need to get our core technology up to speed so that we become connectable with the outside market as trade finance counterparties. And if we can do that, then we can start to connect more seamlessly, digitally, in a more agile, more efficient, more effective way with multiple counterparties. I'm also a huge believer in SaaS-based technology, so software as a service. So different banks, different companies sharing common platforms. Because if you do that, then there are cost benefits to be able to do that because you're sharing in the costs of the development. But there's also interoperability benefits because then you're all using the same API gateway. And instead of having to do multiple integrations to a solution in the market, you can do one integration. And that interoperability word is a big part of the barriers to being able to digitize trade. There's two elements to interoperability. One is technical interoperability, so the ability for different platforms to talk to each other digitally without human intervention. And the other is legal interoperability. And I mentioned earlier on about different legal frameworks, different legal jurisdictions across countries, regions, and so on, which govern the exchange of electronic documentation. So on the interoperability side, obviously APIs are helping to drive that. But APIs is part of the story because the problem is if you end up with multiple API standards, then you don't generate the interoperability you need. So the key word is standardization. And if we can start to standardize different document formats, so the bill of lading formats, et cetera, and then standardize the API calls that go with those documents and with trade transactions, then we'll start to achieve that level of interoperability. Open banking in the EU and the UK on the retail side is a very good example of how, if you standardize APIs, you can start to create more seamless digitization. And then on the legal interoperability side, the UN recently produced or published MELITA, the Model Law for Electronic Transferable Records, which is a base for countries then to bring a more standardized legal framework into place to be able to exchange electronic documents in a, you know, legally efficient manner. And the UK is one of the latest countries to adopt that with the Electronic Trade Documents Act. So just going back to that element of standardization, it's a huge challenge that we all face. And one of the things that interests me is I don't think we do a good enough job at identifying where there already is good standardization or good examples of standardization and leveraging that. And I'll give you some examples. So the ICC Digital Standards Initiative has recently published standard document and API formats for guarantees and standby letters of credit. But that benefit will not be leveraged until technology providers, banks, and companies start to adopt those common standards. If you look at one of the challenges that we have with exchanging electronic documents, it's digital identification, legal entity identifiers. GLIF, the Global Legal Identity Foundation, they're probably the leading provider of legal entity identifiers. And again, you know, something to leverage. The Digital Container Shipping Association has now agreed on a standard common format for electronic bills of lading. But again, unless everyone else adopts that who has electronic bills of lading, we won't be able to benefit and leverage from that. And then for me, one of the most obvious areas of standardization that we all see on a day-to-day basis is barcodes. The first ever barcode was produced and scanned in 1973 by a company called GS1. GS1 is still the sole producer of barcodes globally. And today there are over 10 billion barcodes scanned every single day globally. And when you think about barcodes, barcodes form a part of supply chains in a massive way. Everything from scan and pack solutions on a factory floor, all the way through to when you go and buy something in your supermarket and you go to checkout.
So, and one of my other questions on this, and I think you've alluded to it, is essentially, to my mind, one of the ways technology helps in this space is you create some sort of large platform or ecosystem in which you have all of the various providers you need. Someone wants to sell something to another country, they can find the customer, they can find the financing, there's some sort of smart contract that triggers payments at different stages, so when, say, customs. But how do you onboard people to these platforms? And do you sometimes have a problem where you've got, say, competing platforms and they're trying to pull people away? So, you know, it's one of those things where I suppose everyone would agree that if we could just have this perfect ecosystem, it would be great. But it's difficult to see how you get there in a competitive market where companies want to gain market share and don't necessarily want to share all of their great ideas with their competitors.
Yeah, so my own view on this is, and people may disagree with this, but it shouldn't be about platforms or a single platform. because whatever happens, we're going to have multiple platforms across the world. There's no way we're going to have one platform. It's unrealistic. It's unattainable. But if we have common standards, common document standards, common API standards, a common language, if you like, which all of those different platforms can talk to each other in, and then a common legal framework within which they can exchange that data and exchange those documents, then you get the interoperability you need without having to have single platforms or just a few platforms. And then the beauty is that, you know, to what Shamika was saying about commercial banks in developing countries and so on, they don't need to then go and, you know, integrate to third-party platforms. If they can update their own platforms to those common standards, then they can start to communicate with the wider ecosystem on a more seamless basis. And that's when we can start to properly achieve that accessibility and that inclusion from a trade finance perspective, because that's when you can start to join up all the data across supply chains from a trade finance perspective, so that you can collaborate more to make the right decisions across different buyers and suppliers, et cetera, globally.
And Shamika, that sounds, feels like a good time to come to you. You were mentioning earlier the sort of opportunities for the people, companies, communities you work with that digitalization offers. Does what James says resonate with you? Is there any sort of nuances or specifics you'd like to draw out in terms of things that are working, things that don't?
I mean, it resonates well. And what Anna was saying too, there are a lot of innovations are happening in certain spaces like insurance and financial services and so forth. Yes, these innovations are happening. And in fact, one of the fastest growing areas of trade is digitally deliverable services. You know, these are the insurance and financial services, software, streaming of music, video, ebooks, distance learning, and even, you know, recreational services like offering online yoga or meditation classes from another continent. In fact, you know, this kind of trade, we call them the digitally deliverable services. They account for 55% of global services exports in 2023. And there's a massive potential for developing countries. But, you know, for all what James has been saying, all the difficulties developing countries have, and we see it is on the ground, because if you look at the least developed countries, they are only 0.2% of global exports of these digitally deliverable services. You know, I think some of the, you know, the financial side, both Anna and James discussed, and let me give you some other prerequisites to break into this sort of markets, which are growing really fast. Is of course, is that you need the faster internet connectivity, you need digital skills, you know, the finance we all talked about. Now, you see, when you think about developing countries, I think we have been talking about this in this podcast. I mean, all countries need a strong regulatory environment that puts online transactions on a firm legal footing to give, you know, good protection for buyers and sellers. That's the only way you can operate in the digital space. You know, what does this mean? It means there needs to be provisions for data protection, data privacy, consumer protection, and provisions against cybercrime. If these regulatory pieces are not in place, even if I would love to have the yoga class streamed into my home from somewhere in, say, South Asia, I would be scared to add my personal information and credit cards to some unknown platform. So that's where the developing countries are. Let me give you a number which is kind of shocking and also sad. Less than half of least developed countries have adopted data protection, privacy, and consumer protection legislation. Even when they have this legislation, they are not updated. As James was saying, you know, this is a field that's moving very fast, and you need to constantly update and your cybersecurity, your data protection laws, and this is not done. Enforcement is lacking. So yes, there are enormous opportunities in the digital space to engage in e-commerce and these digitally deliverable services I talked about. But, you know, many developing countries, I mean, I guess the most developing countries are not there yet.
I think that's a really important point, which is that we're discussing digitization and its benefits, but absent, I suppose, the infrastructure, regulatory and physical underpinning it, it can only do so much. And I'm conscious that we're sort of drawing up towards the end of our discussion. I thought I'd just sort of maybe finish by asking all of you, you know, sort of digitization. I get the sense that we're generally all optimists here in terms of thinking that it will deliver benefits both for the people financing transactions, global trade in general, and for inclusivity and other people getting there. But I'm just wondering if there's anything maybe we've missed. Are there any other benefits out there, any other risks? I'm thinking in terms of anti-money laundering, for addressing risk assessment, for seeing off corruption. I just want to make sure we haven't missed anything before we draw to a close. I might go back to you, Sharmika, and then just go around and we can treat this as the sort of closing comments.
I mean, I absolutely agree with you, Sam. I think there's a lot of potential out there. And I think this is, you know, it's an optimistic world out there. And let me tell you, it's not all bad news. For example, UNCTAD's largest technical assistance program is called ASICUDA, and which is, you know, run from my division. ASICUDA helps countries to digitalize trade processes. We start with customs, you know, automate the customs processes, and then across all government agencies, you know, get all the processes into, you know, automated. And ASICUDA is in 102 countries and territories, and we have seen firsthand the wide range of benefits, from cutting red tape by simplifying processes and procedures, to reducing time and cost to traders to comply with regulations, and to increasing transparency, reducing corruption, and to increasing government revenues. Let me give you a couple of examples. In Angola, for example, customs revenues increased by 44% in 2018 after the first year of ASICUDA operations, you know, after the first year of the customs automation. And this went on because in 2019, the customs revenue went up by 13%. And we have seen, you know, we talk about the faster clearance and making it easy for traders. We've seen in the Gambia, they managed to reduce the average clearance time for goods at customs by 50%. I think, Sam, you also talk about risk management. And let me give you an example of Guinea. The risk management system implemented by ASICUDA resulted in an accuracy rate of 93% in the identification of non-compliant declaration. So a lot of things happen. The list goes on. But I want to say at the end, the what determines the success is not so much the technology, but the human factor. And let me give you just one aspect. You know, these are not easy reforms, this whole, you know, digitalization of procedures and processes, and especially when it comes to international trade, because they go against vested interest. You know, change management is at the core, and you know, these reforms need coordination across government ministries. So they are very difficult to pull. Unless there is strong political leadership, these massive automation projects of the public sector would not succeed. In fact, the political leadership is the one necessary ingredient for success.
Thank you. James?
So I said at the start of this podcast that I think one of the wonderful things about trade finance is that everything we do, you can link to an individual exchange of goods and services or an individual contract. And therefore, the amount of data that is inherent in everything that we do is potentially huge. We need to digitize so that we can harness that data. If we can harness that data, then we can start to manage all of the various risks we talked about earlier on, the KYC, the AML, the financial crime, the counterparty risk. We can manage that so much more effectively and efficiently, which will then reduce the cost of trade finance and increase the accessibility of trade finance. So for me, the potential benefits of doing this are huge to the world and to global trade if we can get this right. The other point that we haven't registered at the moment is a lot of that data that's inherent that I was talking about is also very valuable from an ESG perspective or a climate perspective, because then you can start to track carbon intensities of trade routes or individual shipments. you can start to track the social side of ESG as well, because you know the origin of goods, et cetera, you know, throughout the life cycle. So there's huge power in that data, and there's huge value to be had globally, you know, in terms of trade and all the benefits that trade can give if we can get that right. I would, though, say that this is not something we can achieve tomorrow. This is a long journey. You know, we've talked about the complexities, all the counterparties, the laws, the frameworks. It will take time, many years, but if we get this right and we start moving in the right direction, there will be significant benefit along the way as well. And that's the vision that I have.
Thank you. And Anna, other than obviously lots of data being great from a reporting perspective as a journalist, because it's more information for you to you to get your teeth into, I wondered if you had any sort of final thoughts.
Yeah, it's a sort of a cost benefit thought. So sort of the thing that sort of keeps me awake at night when it comes to trade finance is how innovative or new platforms, new effective, although they're not regulated as, which is the point, payment service providers or transactors, how they lack or fail to do due diligence on recipients within a trade of any kind, or ultimately finance moving that enables other trades, be it of services or goods, and where that leaves the cost for people that want to do things in the right way. So traditional payment service providers or traditional banking or traditional trade finance providers, where regulation will increase because of the geopolitical risk we're seeing and the imposition of sanctions, and access will therefore fall for people that want to do the right thing, or they might turn to platforms where there's less transparency. So I just worry about sort of the health, not to sound too negative, but I worry about the health of the transactions that form these complex chains we've been describing, in a world where people might be able to sidestep regulation as the volume of transactions and the opaque nature of where some of those money movements take place makes it much harder for regulators. And I think the onus is on particularly developed countries to consider how their regulation might have an impact on some of the traditional trade finance providers in terms of access. So they, you know, the higher, the more they regulate those they can, the more expensive they make access to that finance, and the more they might push people into these slightly harder to track, albeit very exciting and quick and innovative routes for transactions. So so I think there can be a dark side to the innovation as well, if we don't think about the long-term impacts and the humans at the end of some of these transactions.
Thank you, Anna, and thank you, everyone. You certainly left me with some food for thought. I'm going to draw it to a close there. I'd like to thank you all for joining us on the first episode of AIG's Credit Notes podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for a really interesting discussion.
Thanks so much for having me.
Future episodes, we're going to discuss some of the things that have been raised today. So we're going to be discussing how climate change will impact global trade in terms of supply chain disruption. We're going to be discussing the geopolitics of trade dependency. And we're also going to do a bit of a deeper dive on sanctions policy. Thank you all again. From me, Sam Lowe, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.